funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between who we are and how we communicate, and how do we decide what style to use with whom? Race, ethnicity, and culture shape the way we experience and understand the world. And without even thinking much about it, many of us toggle between different styles of communication depending on who we're talking to. So how does this code switching, what does this code switching say about us as individuals, and how does it affect life and relationships in broader U.S. society? My guests today both work on NPR's Code Switch, an interactive multimedia initiative that explores language, ethnicity, and culture. Jean Demby is lead blogger for Code Switch, and Louise Clemens is Code Switch team editor and senior editor for diversity at NPR. Guys, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Jean, you have called code switching a dialogue that spans cultures. Will you elaborate on that a little bit?
So code switching is this thing we all do a lot of times very reflexively when we are toggling, as you said, between different contexts. So the way I speak at work is very different than the way I speak amongst my friends, which is very different from the way I speak to my mom, which is very different from the way I speak, you know, to a supervisor. And so we all do these things in a lot of ways. And, you know, we're all jumping between different cultures, not just ethnic cultures, but kind of social cultures.
Is there something more that makes us more sensitive to it when it takes place in an ethnic context?
I mean, I know Luis and I talk about this a lot, but Luis will slip into Spanish when he's talking to his wife on the phone, and I will slip into slang when I'm speaking to another young African-American person. Sensitivity is, I mean, we're always thinking about these things almost like subconsciously, and so we do it without even thinking.
Luis, how did it become clear that code switching was a good framework to use in examining race, culture, and ethnicity in the United States as it is right now, today in 2013?
I think it becomes effective because it is now more and more difficult to avoid being in a situation, either at church, at work, at school, in society at large, where you're not rubbing up against someone who is fundamentally different from you in a very basic way. And so that notion of how do you communicate across difference, how do you talk across some of these barriers and make yourself understood and make sure that someone can respond in a similar way, that became a central piece of our conversations when we're putting the team together.
Is there something unique about the ways that we code switch in the United States as compared with other countries that may be countries of immigrants that may have a lot of ethnic and racial diversity?
I think just the sheer range of code switching in this country is what's amazing, what's different. I mean, as Jean was saying, if I were to take a call from my wife right now, I'd say, hola, mi amor, estoy platicando en una entrevista, te tengo que dejar, hang up, and then I'd switch, and we'd continue on this conversation. And if I were to be interrupted by my daughter calling, I'd have a conversation much more likely to be in Spanglish. Mm-hmm. It's the range of code switching, and it's as Jean was saying, it depends on who you are speaking to and what the context is. I mean, I define it by my experiences at the neighborhood park. At the neighborhood park, I am Cecilia and Natalia's father. I am Mercedes's husband. I'm never just Luis.
Even though sometimes you might like to be and get some peace and quiet.
I wouldn't mind.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up the phone because you guys have used, there's a really funny little sketch by Key and Peele that you've used to sort of explain this project to people who are still a little bit unclear. And I think you know the one that I'm talking about, but maybe you can first explain visually, we're not going to spoil the surprise here, if you explain visually what's going on in the sketch we're about to play.
So there are two men played by Key and Peele, the two comedians, who are on the phone, on their respective cell phones, on a street corner, and they begin to change the way they speak. They're not speaking to each other, but they begin to change the way they speak because they're in proximity to each other.
They see one another and they respond.
Right.
Because you're my wife and you love the theater and it's your birthday.
Great. Unfortunately, the orchestra is already filled up, but they do have seats that are still left in the dress circle. So if you want me to get them theater tickets right now, I'm going to do it right
now. What's up, dog? I'm about 5 minutes away.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, cool. No, they're all good singers.
Yeah, son.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, man, I'm telling you, man, I'm about to cross the street.
Nah, they got that one dude in it that you love, man. He gonna be in it, yeah.
Come on, man. You know I'm almost there, all
right? Right, no, I'm gonna pick your ass up at 6:30 then. Cool. All right. Yeah. The parking's free. So they got that
on. Oh my God, Christian, I almost totally just got mugged right now.
that almost seems like it was written for to explain what Code Switch is doing and how, and we've all seen that happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We've all done it, I think. You know, you may deepen your accent when you speak to certain people. Like if you have a Texas twang or if you have a Louisiana drawl, you may play that up just to signal that you are part of something and that people should orient themselves to you in a certain way.
So to me, there's a sort of beauty to that ability to communicate. But there are people who you know, experience these interactions and find them to be somehow a reflection that people are not being entirely sincere or are not reflecting exactly who they are. Do you know, have you experienced this from people who are kind of trying to understand the concept and commenting on it?
Look, when you're talking about race, when you're talking about ethnicity, when you're talking about being different in some fundamental way from someone else that you're speaking with, there's an awkward moment. And what I like to tell journalists at different places when I travel around the country at different stations, you know, being in an awkward position is our job. Forcing ourselves to speak across those differences, to be universally understood, is part of communicating effectively whatever news or stories you've gathered. And it's also just very basic communication.
So part of this project all along has been a really robust ability by people who are listening on the radio or go to the website to respond. You have reserved the right to sort of delete comments that are inappropriate. Can you talk about the ones that you have decided to pull out of the discussions?
Well, one of the things that can happen a lot is that conversations have become derailed. We really want the space to be a space where people can have honest conversations about what they're thinking about race and about culture and ethnicity. But we can't, or we don't want it to be a space in which people are kind of disparaging other groups. And that can happen really quickly, as you might imagine on the internet. If you ever looked in a comment section, it can devolve really quickly. And so we kind of have to moderate. We kind of have our template is a dinner party, right? We want everyone to come, you know, and have a civil, polite, fun conversation. But we don't want it to, you know, you can't come into our house and flip over our dining room table, you know? I mean, we do want to kind of be respectful to people. In order to have a space in which people feel like they can comment safely, we kind of have to make sure that there's a level of decorum, which is kind of different from a lot of comment sections.
Is it?
I would add one thing, and that's, you know, when we're talking about race, it's awkward. It's difficult. Lots of sensitivities are involved. People are very afraid about how they come off. So what you have to ensure in that sort of environment is civility. Mm-hmm. And just asking people to think about talking online they would if they were on air.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, pretend that everybody knows who you are and you have to stand behind your comments.
That you have to own what you say and that you have to be willing to listen to the other person and respond.
Is it easy to identify inappropriate comments in a sort of Potter Stewart, I know it when I see it way, or is this often a source of debate on the team?
I think it is hard to suss out when, I mean, it's not, there's not some bright line, right? Sometimes, you know, they're, in part because you can't assume the intent of the person who's commenting, right? I mean, there are people who are asking questions that, you know, walk up, you know, they like inch up to some dangerous, or not dangerous, but kind of crude thinking that are asking out of, they really want their question answered. I mean, they're not, you know, trolling as it were. And there are people who might ask the same question who are clearly trying to elicit a certain reaction. And so it's very contextual sometimes from comment to comment, like what someone may be trying to get across or what they may be trying to glean from the conversation. And so we have to kind of judge it on a comment-to-comment basis.
There are some bright lines, though. I mean, whenever I see the term Nazi pop up, that's generally a good sign that the discussion as such has gone to pot.
Absolutely.
Do you Do you think there's a reason that race and ethnicity, we go there faster than so many other sensitive topics? We get to places where we feel like we have tried our hardest and we can't communicate. There are a lot of other things that it seems like we're willing to put more effort into to understand fully. What is it? Is it just a sense, do you think, that people feel that they can't make themselves understood?
I think it's two things. I think there's a genuine fear of coming off as sounding racist. Mm-hmm. I think in polite, you know, civic settings and work and school and whatnot, what people fear the most is coming off as being a bigot.
Mm-hmm.
And that drives a lot of the wariness of the discussion. So what we've learned from this project is that we're as much helping frame a discussion that is safe, that is civic-minded, that is civil about race, as we are talking about specific issues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems like an objectively good thing that people today recognize that racism is a shameful thing, right? That it's bad to be a bigot. But maybe that gets in the way, not in the framework that you've created here, but of honest discussion in American society.
You know, I'd say a couple of things. First off, I'm a journalist, so I'm biased towards the value of listening and responding. That's a professional bias. And one I'm happy to own. So it's true that if you're not a journalist, you might not share that bias. So I understand people's reluctance. But unless you're willing to reach across those gaps of all sorts in your life, well, then you might not get questions answered. You might not be able to share your opinions. And the other beautiful thing about being a journalist is we have license to talk to an incredibly wide range of people. So, yes, it is easier for us because, well, that's our job.
How do you seek out people for this project that you want to feature in stories or talk to? I mean, everybody knows a limited number of people. Where do you go looking for people who might typify some of the issues that you're trying to explore?
We actually literally ask everyone. We have conversations in the office. One of a major font of great stories has been, for us, has been Twitter. I mean, we just tell us about, you know, last week we did a story. Tell us about, for people who have ethnic names, what is the name you use when you go to Starbucks so they don't mispronounce your name? And we got this, like, ocean of responses, and some of them are really funny, and some people had blogs in which they started taking pictures of their lattes and all the misspellings of their names, and so it just became, these conversations are often very fun and organic, and we're just kind of joking around with people, and then they actually become like, oh, well, this is a larger thing, let's open this up, let's write about this, let's do a piece on this.
I think the other part is we take advantage of, I mean, we're a diverse group, as we should be, given the team and the nature of what we cover. And so we have a pretty broad range of experiences within that group, a broad range in terms of age, in terms of whether people have children, grown or young, what have you. So we take advantage of the little sort of micro experiences that we have on our own, share those, and then we spend an awful lot of time just talking as a group and trying to figure out what might spark people's interest. And as Gene was saying, when it comes to Twitter, we go out there and we ask questions. I mean, really, the one that's been the most successful is what odd or hilarious or ridiculous question have you been asked?
Oh, based on your ethnicity or your race.
Or your perceived ethnicity.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And we got an incredibly broad range of responses.
Luis Clemens is here. He is senior editor for diversity at NPR. Gene Demby is here as well. He's lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch project. We're talking about Code Switch this hour. We would love to hear from you, whether your experiences, your response to the project. If you'd like to ask a question, you can also call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Gene Demby, who is lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch Project, and Luis Clemens, who is editor for Code Switch and senior editor for diversity at NPR. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So going back to what you were talking about, you asked people what is the strangest thing they'd been asked based on their perceived ethnicity. What kinds of responses did you get from people?
Oh, gosh. We had one person who was Jewish say that they had been asked, where are your horns?
Oh, my goodness.
We had seen...
Was someone being deliberately ridiculous and racist?
If I remember that correctly, I think that person was just young. I think they were they were in like grade school, and so this was like a classmate who asked them.
Wow.
Yeah, and later ones, people asking Asians, do you see the world differently because of the shape of your eyes? Mm-hmm. You're Latino, you don't look Latino. Mm-hmm. You sure you're Latino? That sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes when you hear some of that, does it not make you want to throw up your hands and go hide under the covers?
I mean, I think we laugh about it a lot because so many of us have had some experiences along those lines where people have kind of done the, well, what are you? It depends on the context. I mean, I'm pretty obviously a black dude, but when I moved to Brooklyn... I would get this question a lot. Brooklyn has a really large Caribbean population. And so people would say, are you from Jamaica? Or is your family from Jamaica? And I'm like, nope, I'm just regular black. And they're like, are you Haitian? Or are you, from Trinidad? And I'm like, nope. And so I think this is something that people do. I think in all kinds of populations, just they want to figure out who you are so they can figure out how they should relate to you, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. And that's one of those things I think that is different for people of color than it is for European Americans. Very often, I mean, you know, my family's Irish and German, and I'm not often asked, like, where my family's from, you know. Or if I'm asked, I assume that the answer is El Paso, you know.
Yeah, there was a woman who had this very funny routine that we shared on YouTube in which someone was asking her, you know, where are you from? And she's like, I'm from San Francisco. And the guy's like, no, where are you from? And she's like, oh, well, my family's from Korea. And then she asked him where he's from. He's like, oh, I'm just regular American. And so I think the idea is that, you know, we still have this default idea of whiteness as kind of default American identity.
Right. And then it's interesting because if you go back in history, that hasn't always been the case, but it seems like it's really easy for white Americans, European Americans today to take for granted that they've always been fully assimilated into the culture.
Right. In a way that's much more, you know, as you just said, more complicated than actual history looks, right? I mean, Irish American people and German American people. I mean, these were people who were thought to be of different races at one point, right? Whiteness has come to swallow up a whole lot of groups that it did not previously include. I mean, Jewish people were not considered part of like white, the general idea of whiteness, right? And so it's actually one of the things we talk about on the team a lot is like what whiteness will expand to include next. Like at some point, will there just be more people who are white, who have last names that end in EZ? They would have been, you know, in 2050, maybe those people would have been people who we consider Latino in 2013, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about that, on the one hand, the idea of, you know, sometime in the future, like a universally sort of medium brown colored world, you think maybe we would get rid of racism. But it seems like there's always some category that people want to find to diminish the full Americanness of someone else.
You know, it's not just to diminish, although that's certainly been the case historically today, but also to identify ourselves and define ourselves as different. You know, if we're talking about ethnicity, you know, before considering myself Latino, I consider myself a husband, a father, a journalist. Mm-hmm. It's not until you get down to number four, number five, that Latino pops up on that list. I mean, so, and that makes me different from someone who is not married, who does not have children in a very basic way. Mm-hmm. And it means I also have something universally in common with every other parent out there.
Hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have Martin on the line in Dallas. Hi, Martin.
Hello, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
My question is, I was wondering on the blogs if any discussion about socioeconomic and classes come up, and if people are engaging in a conversation about class alongside with race. And that's my question.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, conversations about class are almost inextricable from conversations about race. I mean, class is so insinuated into race, and so much of when we talk about we did a story on the wealth gap. There's disparities in wealth between Latinos and Black people and white people. And so when we talk about those things, we kind of have to talk about it's not as these things are racialized. They are about class, but they are also kind of very intrinsically about race. The reason these gaps exist are because of our history. And so a lot of times we're having these conversations, we're teasing out the history of why these gaps exist in the first place.
And just to add to Gene's point, I mean, in reference to Martin's question, you know, there are so many stories that we do where this is inevitable. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking Fisher v. Texas. Mm-hmm. Any discussion around affirmative action, it's part and parcel of the discussion.
Is there a social consequence to not code switching?
Well, interestingly enough, I spoke to a sociolinguist at USC named Sami Alim, who writes about hip hop and about code switching a lot. And one of the examples he used was Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney had an inability to switch between contexts, which Alim argued was a huge deficit for him in 2012. And you look at someone, compare him to someone like George W. Bush, right, who could speak to evangelicals in a very specific way. And this is a guy who's from Connecticut, right, who grew up in, you know, a blue blood Connecticut family, and he could speak in a Southern drawl. And all those things communicated that he was, you know, part of that group, right? If he spoke in front of evangelicals, or he spoke in front of a regular people in a folksy Texas twang, he was communicating to them that he was just a regular guy, and he was a person who was approachable and normal. And so the ability to talk to people as a member of their group, as a member of their tribe, as it were, is a huge social advantage. And if you listen to Sami Alim, if you buy his argument, then it actually was of great political consequence as well.
We actually have two brief clips here of President Obama. The first is from the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and then the second one is when he went to visit Ben's Chili Bowl. And you'll hear two sort of different ways of addressing the people around him. We'll hear those now.
Actually, my advisors were a little worried about the new rap entrance music. They are a little more traditional.
So you hear those two, and they're both the same man, and they're both someone who is communicating to the audience around him. There are people who feel that one or the other somehow must be more authentic. Can you talk to that, the idea that there is a sense maybe that code switching is possible, but one is the real you and one is something else that you're putting on?
Actually, I would argue that that's not true at all. I would argue that we are all of these things, right? Obama is a guy who lived on the South Side of Chicago, and so he speaks to Black people and Black Southsiders in a certain way, right? He's mm-hmm. also a dude who went to, pardon me for saying dude, that's code switching, who went to Harvard Law. And so he speaks with all the mannerisms and inflections, you know, that come with that social location. And so we all do this, and we are not, when Luis speaks to his wife in Spanish and his daughter in Spanglish, and he speaks to us as our editor, all of those things are Luis.
Right.
All of those things are very much Luis. None of those things is not Luis.
To be clear, that's not my argument that I was putting out there for you to address.
No. But we all do it. I mean, I was walking home. I live about 10 minutes from work. I was walking home one day, and I noted just the way I spoke to two different people. One was a white woman and one was a black guy. And I just made eye contact with one person, with the woman, and she said, she said hello. I said, hello, how are you? And then the guy 10 feet behind her, he's like, what's good with you, bro? I was like, what's good with you, man? Like, it was just very, and I didn't even, it was just reflexive. I mean, we don't, so often we do these things. we are not even thinking about them. We just do them. We are orienting ourselves to our environment.
And that said, when you do think about them, as sometimes politicians will try and orient their speeches and their way of speaking to a given audience, it's that inauthenticity that causes problems. I mean, I remember Hillary Clinton being made fun of at one point because she was speaking in what, as close as she could manage to a Southern drawl. And people, you know, pinged her for doing something that was not her.
Right.
Right.
So, like, yeah, if it's not part of you, don't try to create it, because it's not going to work.
It's going to sound and feel awkward.
Mm-hmm. It seems there are certain cases, too, where there's some kind of hierarchy suggested by, in any given interaction between two people, the person who code switches. Does that make sense? So, in other words, you know, like, you know, an undergrad will speak to a university professor in a certain way. The professor is unlikely to turn around and speak like an undergrad in order to facilitate communication.
I hope not. That would be excruciating. but I think you touch upon an important point. It's about trying to communicate across a chasm here. You're talking about someone, there may be 40 years of difference in age and life experience and knowledge in the full range, and they're trying to find a common language that they can speak to one another and make themselves understood. I mean, it's what your high school English teacher tells you is the value of learning to write clearly. It's so that everyone can understand what you're saying.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Renee in Dallas. Hey, Renee.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I'm a baseball fan, and I get very, very frustrated, especially here in Texas, with broadcasters totally butchering Spanish surnames of ball players. Mm-hmm. I kind of, you know, take it for granted when the games are up north, but here in Texas, there's just no excuse. And of course, language being part of culture, I get very, very, very frustrated. Could you respond to that?
Sure. I mean, look, I've cringed. I forget how many times I've heard someone butcher Yasiel Puig's name. And, you know, and as you say, rightly, in Texas, you know, you've got far less excuse than someone who is from, say, the northern reaches of Maine, where there's not much of a Latino population. There's no history there. There's no surrounding culture there. But at the same time, I try and be, forgiving and generous. As long as people are making an honest effort, I generally let it slide when someone mispronounces my own name.
Was that a process? Was there a point at which it used to make you crazy?
That's interesting, yes. So I was in college, and I wrote an essay called Luis, Not Lewis, now, which seems painfully earnest and sanctimonious in retrospect, and thank God that was 25 years ago. But yes, it is a process, and it goes from growing up in Miami, going to a school in a heavily Latino area, living in a heavily Latino area, and then going away to college in Maine, actually, and being one of, I don't know, I think 4, 5, 6 Latinos in a class of a few hundred. So, yes, it is a question of personal growth, and it's a question of growing a thick skin along the way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Janae in Dallas. Hi, Janae.
Oh, hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks to your panel. I had a question. My book club just read a book. It's called The Walk of Other Suns. Your participants may be familiar with it, but it was about the African-American migration from the south to the north. Mm-hmm. And I'll briefly read what she says in the book. She said, with the stroke of the pen, many Eastern and Southern Europeans wipe away their ethnicities by adopting Anglo-Saxon surnames and melting into the world of the privileged native-born whites. You were talking about the ability of Europeans to meld into culture. Your thoughts on, because of I am African-American, that oftentimes people don't know when they're talking to me that they are, but when they see me, that's something that I can't hide, nor can I, no matter what I change my name to. Can you speak to that? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Thanks for your call.
That is a fantastic book, by the way. The Warmth of Those Suns is a masterwork. If you have not read it, you should read it as a masterpiece of history. But to her point, I mean, this is, you know, one of the great one of the issues in the definitions of whiteness and its kind of flexibility is that whiteness has always been kind of defined against blackness. It's not, you know, we tend to think of race on a continuum, which is a crude way of thinking of it. But blackness has been the thing against whiteness has been defined. And so what you don't see is an expansion of blackness. What you do see is an expansion of whiteness. And so Irish Americans and Jewish Americans, as we said before, can become white. And, you know, in the future, we may see a world in which Asian American people who would be classified as Asian Americans in 2013, will become people we assume or we identify as white. But it doesn't work the other way, really. You don't become black, which is a really fascinating kind of quirk of American racial taxonomy.
Do you find that many people who have responded or that you've spoken to for this project, they feel that they can understand the experience of others, but that other people don't understand their experiences?
You know, sometimes you see this frustration going across currents, either on Twitter or in the comments section. And one of the things we're working on is a piece sort of laying out a flowchart about how to talk about race, how to talk about things that are thorny, and how to do so in a way that doesn't leave anyone feeling slighted or ill at ease, and that provides some sort of map, a how-to guide. But sure, of course, I mean, think about it. You know, the experiences, I use Northern Maine because I've been there, of someone who's grown up in Aroostook County in Northern Maine, is intrinsically different from the experiences of people in Del Rio or Eagle Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a hard gap to bridge, period.
My guests this hour are Louise Clemens, who is senior editor for diversity at NPR, and Jean Demby, lead blogger for the Code Switch Project. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about NPR's Code Switch project with lead blogger Jean Demby and editor Louise Clemens, who is also senior editor for diversity at NPR. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So to the extent that there is something of an age gap here in that younger people find it easier or more comfortable to move back and forth and to code switch perhaps than others, does it get harder as we get older, or does each successive generation perhaps gain some facility for moving comfortably throughout different segments of American culture?
Well, I think just in terms of sheer numbers, the number of people who in some way feel compelled to code switch is growing. And whereas certainly in Texas you have a long, long history of Mexican-Americans code switching back and forth, now you've got Mexican-Americans in North Carolina who find themselves in a situation where they're trying to make themselves understood with white folks and black folks in North Carolina. Multiply that scenario times 50 in a whole bunch of different states with infinite number of variations, and you see why there's an increasing amount of it.
And I'd also jump in here and say that, you know, one of the really consequential linguistic developments of the late 20th century was hip hop. I mean, mm-hmm. there is an entire generation of people who have this idiom, and they're Black and they're white and they're Asian American and they're Latino. And so many people are familiar with each other's kind of jargons, or of a very specific jargon, that the kind of baseline language is very different for people under the age of, let's say, 25.
And even older. I mean, you know, we've talked about Senator Marco Rubio, mm-hmm. and the fact that he quotes Wiz Khalifa on mm-hmm. the Senate floor. I mean, there is an age point, you know, from which hip hop is lingua franca.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's something that is part of the cultural air that we breathe. And below a certain age, it's a common language too. Mm-hmm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Brittany in Dallas. Hi, Brittany.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. I enjoyed this program. This is a topic that needs so much discussion. And, you know, I lived in the Carolinas for 25 years, and as a white person, it very much increased my sensitivity to, you know, race situation. And, you know, I see that people overall, they don't consider themselves bigots, but they practice what I call everyday racism, and that they're just, it's just, they are not trying to be mean, but I think they live their life so isolated, white people, and now I see it, this is what's happening with Latinos, too, that they're being so racist with the Latinos, and but I would especially like to, that's just my comment, but I would love to hear what y'all's comments are about kind of Paula Deen's undoing, that I feel like she didn't really, isn't racist maybe in her heart, but she's so isolated and that she has so much everyday racism in her that she created a hostile environment that brought that upon herself. So, but I'd love to hear what y'all have to say about it, and thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
So, Paula Deen. Wow.
I'm going to let you guys comment on what's in her heart, because I'm not going to touch that.
No, here, one thing we like to talk about and use as a sort of operating principle is we try and assume the best of mm-hmm. people, the best intentions. No, we can't read either malice or benevolence into people's heart, but we can judge them by their actions. And, you know, there have been a number of cases where people have made comments involving slurs, either racial or ethnic. You know, we can go down the line. And what is interesting about the Paula Deen case is, of course, her visibility, her high profile, and the fact that it relates to the restaurant that she and her brother operated. I mean, what one thing that as just a point of fact is worth mentioning. The deposition, which courtroom deposition, which became the source for much of this information, was included in full in the legal proceedings, and that's rare. That means that on practically every page of that deposition, there was information that suggested, or that was at least evocative, of a hostile work environment of various sorts, not just related to race. Now, whether a judge decides that is the case or not, we'll see.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Buddy in Fort Worth, and I'm actually glad this came up. Buddy says, so German names should be given a German pronunciation, as in Wolf Blitzer. Scottish names must have a extended R. But he says, I'm of Irish descent, so should I say my last name with a decided Irish accent? But he says, will this bring us closer together? I think not. Can you guys, you understand, I think, the spirit of what Buddy's trying to communicate. Will you talk about that a little bit and sort of the difference maybe between pronouncing a name the way someone says it himself or herself and forcing everyone to, I'm not even sure where to go with this.
I think so. Look, I received an email not that long ago from a publicist, a gentleman by the name of Andy Silva. And then the email said, henceforth, I'm going to be known as Hector Andres Silva.
Right.
This was the name that I used when I moved to this country from South America when I was 7 years old. And it just wasn't working as Hector Andres, and therefore we're gone with Andy. And 20 years later, he decides to change. The way I feel about it is you get to pronounce your name however you please. Mm-hmm. You know, if you choose to say Porik or as opposed to Patty, that's fine. Mm-hmm. You get to choose. It's your name. And now you're not, because you choose the Spanish or German or what have you, initial pronunciation, that doesn't mean that you're pushing people away. It means that you're honoring your ancestors. You may choose not to. It may be too much complication. I mean, one of the things, I mean, as Gene was saying earlier, you know, if you go into Starbucks and you want to get your latte on time, you might think twice about using your original name. And that was clear from the response to our questions on Twitter. That happens a great deal.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's just, it just seems like common courtesy to refer to people the way they want to be referred to. I mean, there's not a default way to, you know, to pronounce any number of names, right? And if someone says, I would like my name pronounced this way, or they introduce themselves as, you know, Luis, and you say Louis, that's either just laziness on your part or you know, I guess maybe even like a pointed insensitivity. But I mean, Why would you not want to do that? Why would you not want to refer to someone by the name that they, by the name they refer to themselves as?
And I would say, in terms of race and ethnicity versus the notion of being American, I mean, the fact that you choose to use the original pronunciation of your last name, your first name, whatever name you want to use, does not make you any less American. Does not mean that you're trying to drive a wedge between you and your fellow citizens.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's come up occasionally here. People have been upset. If I were to say Silva on the air instead of Silva, there are people who would say, what are you doing? But it seems to me that if that's what, you know, Hector says, then that's how you should say the name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's that funny Saturday Night Live routine from a long time ago where one character asks another, is your name Antonio Mendoza or is it Antonio Mendoza? And Jimmy Smith's response, no, it's just Tony Mendoza.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Steve in Dallas. Hey, Steve.
Hi there, Chris. Great show.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask, I grew up in northwest Louisiana, and I think I've sort of leveled out some of the accent that I have that's related to that region. But I've been told and I've noticed that when I get angry, I'll flip back into that accent. And I wonder if emotion plays into that. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
I definitely think that we code switch back to like languages that are kind of if the language which you've learned to curse in, it happens to be, you know, Spanish, whatever. I think you may jump back to that or the language that you have, like, it's kind of elemental to, you know, the way you formed your language at the beginning. I know Mike's girlfriend was from Arkansas, and when she would talk to her mother, she would suddenly go from this this Bryn Mawr woman to a woman who said, but mama, I said, and she would just, or suddenly just this drawl would come out of nowhere. Like, who are you? I think that that's... just it goes to the idea of like the reflexiveness of these identities we have, right? I had some Caribbean friends who do the same thing when they immediately lapse into patois when they're upset. It's fascinating to watch people do that because, again, it's not even something we're thinking about.
No, and it becomes, I mean, you know, you refer to this happening in your youth and the depth of emotion, Gene, and you know, I've warned people on the team, if you hear me swearing in Spanish, watch out, because that means I am livid. But, I mean, when I speak to my wife, I mean, if it's a discussion that is emotional or tender or what have you, it's often in Spanish. If it's logistics, who's going to pick up which child when? It's English.
Mm-hmm. How does it work in your house, Louise? Do your kids speak English to themselves and Spanish to you, or what's the sort of family dynamic?
So both my children were born in Mexico. The oldest is in grade school here in the U.S., but she actually went through kindergarten in Mexico. And right now we're on the sort of pivot point between where she's going to decide she's going to embrace both speaking both languages, mm-hmm. or she's going to default to responding to my Spanish questions in English. Mm-hmm. This is something, you know, people often talk about what is the fear. People often refer to the fear that Latinos won't speak English. Latinos, press two for Spanish, press two for English, what have you. But the truth is the bigger concern is will Spanish hold on as a language? I mean, in my case, my mother was an immigrant. In their case, technically, they're immigrants. But, I mean, each generation goes on. It becomes tough to hold on. And it's a source of great concern by my wife and I.
How often do you see responses to things that you've posted on the blog or to content that's been made available through this project on the air that make you feel better about where we're headed in this country?
You know, two things. I mean, better and worse. the worse is both Gene and I have been called racist online in response to different posts that we've written. So we joke about, you know, you're racist. No, you're racist. but the things that inspire hope, and you can see a real hunger for good news that relates to race and ethnicity. Just a little while ago, Karen Grigsby Bates, who's the senior member of our reporting team, posted a blog about this wonderful photo from 1963, black and white photo featuring five children, three black children, two white children, horsing around with a shopping cart. And it was a story of how that photographer is now trying to reconnect with each of those individuals, find them, and talk to them. That photo went viral. It sparked more than 600,000 page views of traffic, which is an awful lot. And I can only attribute it to the need to hear good news about race, ethnicity, and to feel that, in fact, we are human first, human above all.
Is there a particular risk to taking this on? I mean, what do you see as the greatest risk, that certain discussions will get inflammatory but not be resolved in a way that is sort of civil and peaceful and productive?
So I'm kind of against the idea of neat resolutions of these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been 250 years that we've looked and we haven't found one yet. Yeah.
Absolutely. If we didn't have, if that bloody war didn't solve all this problem. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where I think that that these things are about kind of incremental progress in the way we think about things and the way we, like, I think our goal is that we want to complicate these conversations. We want them to be conversations that you come away from them with an idea that you maybe didn't have before, and that might change or deepen what the way you think about something, or again, just complicate the way you think about the idea you came into the conversation with. And so about race, I think because we start off defensively in so many places, so I think so many of us start conversations wanting to not be seen as racist, that we don't open ourselves up to points of view or ideas that kind of just challenge the elemental stuff that we believe in.
Yeah, and I think the risk, to answer your question in an additional way, provide a second answer, is that you want to make sure that we continue to stress our commonness, you know, culturally, linguistically, socially.
Luis Clemens is editor of the Code Switch Project and senior editor for diversity at NPR. Gene Demby is lead blogger for Code Switch. Guys, it's been so great to have you on the air. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Send comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.